Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 21st of September, recording at 9:22 p.m., and that's British Summer Time. Now, this being Friday, this is a big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes, but first let's have a quick review of the week's events. Global stock markets, quietly steady, I think would summarize it. And that was true again today for the Asian markets, although China gave up most of its gains on the day, China A shares, that is. The European markets were mostly to the plus side, and in the Americas, mostly to the downside, modest losses. Wall Street saw a rally fade at the close. Although the NASDAQ was up a fraction, but the declines on Wall Street were, 0.01% for the S&P. In long-dated government bond prices, we had seen rallies, a little technical rallies, nothing big, during the first 4 days of the week. Those continued for some, but not for bunds or gilts. The U.S. Treasuries closed just slightly firmer. In currencies, the dollar has been generally soft, sterling quite steady overall, and the euro, which had a good rally up to just over 131, has given up some of that ground and is currently 129.84. Did I mention the dollar? It's a soft tone here overall. And Australian dollar, well, it's again quiet, hovering around this, currently at the 104.44 level. It's around where it's been trading for most of the week. Precious metals were interesting. The rallies sort of ran out of steam on Monday. Then we had a week of small reactions for gold and silver, somewhat bigger reactions for palladium and platinum in particular. And then today we had gold and silver break to new high ground, but they couldn't hold it. Platinum and palladium today were a bit higher. And crude oil, a very interesting week. It was hammered early on in the week, started to recover yesterday a little bit, and that was quite a big turnaround from yesterday's lows. And that buying carried through a little bit further here today. We've got Brent, which I think at its low yesterday was down around 107, is at 111 and change. And the WTI, which was below 91, that's currently 93.15. Might have gotten below, might have briefly moved below 90, that WTI. The grain and bean complex, we had soybeans mostly weaker. We saw wheat and corn steady a little bit. Corn after a fairly sharp decline, wheat near the bottom of its range. Industrial metals, go back to those, they were quietly steady here on the week. Okay, so what's going on overall? Well, we're in the era of quantitative easing in perpetuity, as some people have called it. And understandably so, because this is certainly unprecedented in anything other than extreme wartime conditions, such as World War II. And it's probably more extreme than what we saw then. So that QE, in which the Fed has been very aggressive, and I think we have to describe Bernanke as the modern father of QE, that has been embraced wholeheartedly by the Bank of England. More recently, in the last couple of months, it's been embraced by Mario Draghi, head of the European Central Bank. More recently still, in the last few weeks, we've had the Bank of Japan talking about similar stimulative measures, although you can never quite be sure with the Bank of Japan. But those are certainly the mutterings. And will it be China next? I wouldn't be at all surprised if that was the case. Although China has more concern over inflation, as do the other growth economies, albeit slowing growth economies. And that slower growth has certainly been a theme here overall. But in relation to the QE, I wanted to talk about a theme that veteran subscribers, well, all subscribers, I think, will be very familiar with in terms of discussions here at Fuller Money. And really, it's since that bubble burst in 2000, I have been talking about a period stock market bubble, of course, at particularly the tech and telecoms bubble. I've been talking about a secular valuation contraction cycle. Now, that replaced the valuation expansion cycle that ended in the late 1990s with that bubble. And indeed, we have seen to date this valuation contraction. All you have to do is go back and compare, take Wall Street in particular, take today's valuations in terms of multiples in particular, and compare those with 2000, and they're much lower. Indeed, go back to the 2007 highs, and you will see that today's valuations are also lower. Well, how can that be when stock markets have come back up close to those same levels that we saw back at highs and at that time? And the answer, of course, is that we have had some GDP growth, and more importantly, we have had corporate earnings, which were often quite strong, and therefore corporations have been in a good position to increase dividends, and that has certainly improved their valuations. And we have also seen the multiples come down for those equities as well. But the valuations obviously fluctuate here on a daily basis. And QE in perpetuity, or for the foreseeable future, really can change the picture in terms of those valuation contractions. One example, let's take Europe. The ECB, in the last couple of months, has done a magnificent job in raising the valuations for European equities. But, of course, it's not really able to influence the fundamental the fundamentals behind those companies. So evaluations are higher, but are the earnings higher? Well, no, for the most part, although we do have, again, autonomies within Europe have seen some earnings growth, and those are mostly, but not exclusively, German companies. Now, QE has also been a major factor here behind the rallies that we've seen in the U.S. stock market, including the rally from the beginning of June. And that has lowered valuations somewhat. There is still some corporate growth, albeit slower, and some GDP growth, although slow generally. Overall. Now, we have certainly seen a valuation contraction cycle in China, and its valuations are currently as low as we've seen them for, I would say, at least the last 20 years. But we have yet to see the form of QE that is taking place elsewhere, or other forms of stimulus to cause those valuations to become higher. So what I'm saying here really is that we can have the stock market ranging steadily, and I've maintained all along that the big low was the low in, depending on which indices you're looking at, the fourth quarter of 2008 or the first quarter of 2009, whichever was lower, that was the really big low. And I don't expect it to be tested. I think that would take some sort of exogenous event of biblical proportions, and I don't actually see that happening. Indeed, we have seen the biggest concern in recent years, the European situation, with some very big name, high profile people talking about the imminent breakup of the euro. Well, that hasn't happened, as we've seen, and people are not living in fear of what's going to happen in Europe on tomorrow or Monday, I should now say. So we've seen some crisis abatement, if I can phrase it that way, although not resolution, and nor will we see that for quite some time. But to get back to this point of quantitative easing, it is not impossible that we could see that push stock market valuations higher. In other words, they become more expensive as the shares move upwards beyond what growth and dividend increases would ordinarily call for. So, in other words, we can get some PE ratio expansion in here against the background of that QE. We've seen that so far in the countries where we're seeing the QE, and I think we will see more of it as well. Now, the old saying, make hay while the sun shines, and the sun has been shining in that respect, and we have most stock markets in clear upward trends. Among important markets, China is the one big serial exception to that. But with these valuations and the need for some more stimulus, I think as some of the edginess over the political handover wanes, we will see China improve as well. And that would be very good for the mining story, as I've mentioned, particularly the industrial mining story, as I've mentioned on a number of occasions. If that doesn't happen, then mining shares will remain underperformers, despite the recent strong rally. But I'm taking an optimistic view on that. I don't see China staying at these valuations for all that long. So, what happens then, after assuming that QE does not go on in perpetuity, and of course it won't, then what happens? Well, my feeling, and the feeling of a number of other commentators, is that it's one heck of a lot easier to get into QE. All you have to do is to bypass or trample over the wish of those who are against it, such as the Bundesbank, and then you've got it. But how do you extricate yourself from QE without causing a whole lot of pain? How do you extricate yourself without from the moral hazard that the QE actually creates? How do you prevent bond yields from backing up really very sharply and jeopardizing global GDP growth, possibly quite severely? These are the challenges that lie ahead, and it's been said that Mr. Bernanke's latest announcement on QE, which is, of course, the additional 40 billion a month in asset buying, mostly mortgage asset buying. The comment that that has made his successor's job all that much more difficult, and I think that's certainly going to be true. Now, we don't know what lies down the road all that far, but a QE will end at some point, and I suspect that will be problematic for the market. So again, we're back to make hay while the sun shines, and I do want to be exposed to equities. That's been the case really for the most part in recent years. I certainly don't want to be on the sidelines due to euro fears or double dip recession fears. I don't think there's any indicator, as I've said on many, many, many occasions, more important than monetary policy. So it's don't fight the Fed plus the Bank of England plus the ECB plus the Bank of Japan and counting. One does want to be in this market while the going is good. And of course, because we are in this brave new world, which none of us have really seen before, then we do want to be watching the technical action very, very clearly. And with all humility, there is no point in making big guesstimates as to what's going to happen or how far or how high these markets are going to go. Let's just follow the action in the manner of technical naturalists and see where it takes us. But so far, so good. These trends remain consistent, albeit a little bit overbought in the short term, but consolidating those gains relatively quietly here at the moment. Okay. What else to mention here? These long-dated government bond prices. We had the rallies in the first 4 days of this week, continuing again for a fifth day and a number of these. I don't think I can go on much beyond technical rally, at least not while stock markets are in reasonably good form. I would have thought that the concern over QE and the better performance of equities might well persuade some people to be switching out of bonds and more into equities, of course, where you can certainly find plenty of yields that are better than what we see available in the long-dated government bond markets, or in most of them at any rate. So I would have thought that that will prevent bond prices from rallying all that much further or yields from coming down. But on the other hand, governments are still buying a lot of bonds. And Japanese QE, for sure, was the announcement that they would be buying more JGBs. And therefore, it's quite possible that even if my hypothesis that bonds were topping out, and I was early on that, that even if that is correct now, it could still take a good many months of just mostly ranging. And ditto, the yields could still take a good many more months in that bottoming out base building process overall. But I don't think that changed the longer term outlook, which is that yields move higher over time, certainly as the global economy picks up steam, as it eventually will, although not immediately, despite the QE that we're actually seeing. Incidentally, as an aside on that QE, I'm not sure that it's going to have any effect on employment whatsoever. Although that's the Fed's excuse or justification for pushing on with this QE3, I would have thought that the employment situation is going to be influenced far more by business attitudes, regarding regulation, regarding taxation, regarding the fiscal cliff, what sort of environment we're going to have following the next presidential election, the forthcoming presidential election in November, for which President Obama has increased his lead. So I think those factors are much more important. And then for all the autonomies, it's not just in the USA or whatever other home country they come from, but how the combination of regulation, taxes, healthcare expenditures and other expenditures that they might well face, unions, how that all weighs up versus other countries where they could actually do their business. And my feeling is that the U.S. is not all that competitive for those jobs, although the softness of the dollar overall has improved the outlook somewhat. And we do see some very high-tech jobs, of course, remaining in the United States. But are we going to get widespread manufacturing jobs increasing? Well, I would be skeptical about that. But let's come back to the markets now, and move on to currencies. Clearly, QE is in part intended to keep the dollar soft. But of course, we also have the QE to keep the euro soft, and now Japan introducing QE to what they hope will be a softening, to help soften the yen overall. So these are policies, unstated policies of competitive devaluation overall. And therefore, I think it makes it quite unlikely that we will see any kind of big rally other than temporary safe haven status for the U.S. dollar. For the most part, if the world muddles through in a reasonably satisfactory fashion, we'll see ranging currencies. And that's what I would expect more often than not in the months ahead. What tends to happen, though, particularly as growth starts to pick up, is that you'll see those growth economies, you'll see their currencies firm rather more, particularly those in Asia, and that creates problems in those countries, and they will try to stem the appreciation of their currencies. So you weigh it all up, and there isn't a country around that wants a hard currency. They all want to have competitive currencies, and so they keep interest rates low, they intervene, and the countries that have the biggest economic problems, of course, have these massive QE programs. And that's the background for the gold and other monetary metals story. And I think that all this QE is about as good as it gets in terms of a fundamental background for gold and other monetary metals. Although not everyone has come to that same conclusion yet, partly because they haven't seen all this QE before. But if you have this massive amount of money printing, let's call it what it really is here, money printing by various means, if you have all this going on, debasing and the currencies, and by that I mean, of course, reducing the purchasing power of these currencies, that's going to be very, very bullish on a immediate to longer term basis for these precious metals. On a short term basis, following the impressive rallies that they saw during the four previous weeks up until this week, they just raced ahead. To me, that was a very clear confirmation of the hypothesis that I've been advocating, and that we had transformed in those ranges that contained precious metal prices during the summer months, that marked the changeover from the distribution phase of the big long medium term correction. And these for gold have run about 18 months on average, to the accumulation phase, which I felt we were in, and I think the evidence of the previous 4 weeks strong rally suggests very clearly that we are back in an accumulation phase. And I say, as far as I'm concerned, this QE is just about as good as it gets in terms of a fundamental background. Now, others may counter and say, well, that's too bullish because we have slow growth, and so that curbs demand for precious metals, as does the prior gains that they've seen. So it's too expensive for India, for instance, and the amount of buying that's occurred in India this year, amount of gold buying in India, has dropped significantly. And in the United States, through a really and over here throughout all of Europe, we've seen a big increase in scrap gold as people pawn their less wanted gold jewelry. And this is all true, of course. But then again, if we didn't have the economic weakness which has deterred people from buying gold, deterred jewelry demand for gold and industrial demand for gold and other precious metals all over the world. If we hadn't had that environment, well, we wouldn't have the QE, would we? And I think the QE is more important because it as it undermines the purchasing power of currencies over time, that just provides additional confirmation of the importance of gold and the other precious metals as monetary assets. And what we do see continuing on a month-by-month basis, I'm not sure this has been interrupted at all, or not for very long, and maybe a month or two during 2008, but the steady buying of these bullion funds. And then, of course, central banks have turned from net sellers to net buyers of gold bullion. And I think that's a trend that's very likely to endure for the same reason that other people with capital are buying and holding precious metals. So if we say, in terms of QE, what's it most bullish for? My answer without hesitation would be it's most bullish for precious metals over the medium to longer term. But it has a tendency to lift most asset prices, or if there's a specific asset category that's in crisis, then it cushions the downside risk in terms of prices for those particular assets. Now, what about these industrial commodities, which had become really quite oversold, and industrial metals, I really should say, had become quite oversold? Technically, it looks like they've turned. Just as it looks like the mining shares have turned. Precious metals have led, of course, and gold shares have certainly been performing over the last month and have the potential to continue to perform. The industrial metals are lagging way behind the rises that we've seen in gold and other precious metals. But they are way overextended on the downside, and I have said that they'll be closely allied, their fortunes will be closely, or their prospects will be closely allied with those of China. And China has yet to kick in terms of confirming that not only has a bottom been reached for the stock market, but that the A shares are actually appreciating. Hong Kong's done that some time ago, but the A shares haven't, and I still think that's the important missing cog, if it, if you will, here for this industrial metal share recovery. But I think it will occur. It's and probably in the not too distant future. But if I'm wrong on that, if China continues to drift lower, then that will weigh on those precious metals and certainly, I beg your pardon, weigh on the industrial metal prices and therefore cap the rallies in industrial metal share prices. But so to wrap up on that, they remain a cyclical sector. Overall, and slow growth is obviously a negative, but we have just about every central bank going and every government going, undertaking more measures, including not just the QE but also fiscal expenditure, to improve their economies, and that would improve demand for the industrial metals as well. So I think they're in that pivotal stage where we have the lows are probably in, and where the medium-term prospects are pretty good. But again, China needs to kick in, and that will have a big impact on sentiment overall. It would also help stock markets generally, because we have the Wall Street leash effect. That's been very positive. We also have the less important but nonetheless significant leash influence of China. And that's particularly important for the Asian region, but it also has global reach. That has been negative. For the most part. Okay, and that takes me on to crude oil among the industrial commodities. I've said it over and over again, as have other people, that the fundamentals of supply and demand do not justify the prices that we've actually seen. The prices that we've actually seen reflect speculation. They reflect a degree of hedging in there against the perennial rumors of an Israeli attack on the Iranian nuclear installations, and against further uprisings of the Arab Spring nature in the Middle East and in North Africa. Concerns over production in Nigeria. So this is going to be with us for a few more years yet. And remember, I've said that we're in the second consecutive difficult decade in terms of energy supplies. But that's also been compounded by the fact that a lot of countries are now wanting to move away. A lot of countries, let's say France, Germany, Japan, most of all, wanting to move away from nuclear power in this post-Fukushima era. They're also finding out that they can't really do that. But it gets votes, and it gets support from the Green Party to say that that's exactly what they're going to do. If you ask me, and I don't want to digress too much on this, the world needs much more nuclear power, not less. It needs new generation, much safer nuclear power. It doesn't need patched up old 1950s, 60s, and 70s nuclear plants. But enough of that digression. But there are plenty of other forms of energy. The one that's come on most of all, logically, is the solar, and that's making big inroads, and this can only increase. And we also have the wind farms, although that's an expensive mistake, in my opinion. But we have them, and we will also have continued expenditure to develop so-called renewable energy. And then, of course, we've got the improvements in technology, which are enabling the shale oil and the shale gas exploration and development. So there's no shortage of supplies of energy, and energy will become more plentiful over time, and that should weigh on the prices overall. But that doesn't mean that we won't get periodic spikes to the upside when there are sudden fears that supplies, important supplies of crude oil, are about to be cut off. Hopefully those will be infrequent. Hopefully those will remain infrequent, because they really are game changers. Spikes in crude oil and the crude oil price have always resulted in recessions, and I don't see why it would be any different for the medium term future. So that's means we have to watch the oil price very carefully overall, and I'm relieved to see it take somewhat of a backward step here this week, although I'd like to see it lower still overall. Last but not least, what about these key grains and beans? Well, I think judging from the chart action for soybeans, corn, and to a lesser extent wheat, but wheat didn't rise as much as the others, it does look very much as if corn and soybeans have peaked for the medium term, let's put it that way. And I'm upgrading that from a short-term peak. And that's good news to the extent that it means that prices are not going to become even higher, adding to food price inflation and increasing the scope for price-related shortages, if not actual supply shortages. In other words, running out of the stuff. So food prices still uncomfortably high overall, but at least they're not getting worse. What we really need to see is a good couple of years of surpluses, particularly in the South American, it's global crops, South America, USA, Europe, Asia, and so that reserves can be increased. Will climate conditions be sufficiently stable to allow that to happen? Well, your guess is as good as mine on that. And on that note, I just wish you a terrific weekend. All the best.